care of us. So we start a new Masechta and a new Mishnah. Daf Beis Amud Aleph. Thank you. And this parak is called Dinei Mamonos Kishlosha. We'll have to just close the door. We got some stiff competition there. Okay, so the previous Masechtas in what's called Seder Nezikin on the Bavas, and that's where you'll find the mainstay of the laws of Mamonos. But our Mishnah here wants to tell us that after we've already studied the Bavas, that we know the laws, the basic rules that govern Dini Mamonos in monetary law, now we have to discuss how many judges are we required to have that comprises a Beis Din, the minimum amount of judges, in order to adjudicate in laws of Mamon. So the Mishnah says, Dini Mamonos Bishlosha. Now it's very interesting because after establishing that Dini Mamonos Bishlosha, the Mishnah goes ahead and delineates many different cases, specific cases of Dini Mamonos. So the question is, how exactly do you read this Mishnah? There are two ways of reading the Mishnah. One way to read it is Dini Mamonos Bishlosha, and then you put like a colon afterwards, or a comma. And now I'm going to tell you with like an appositive phrase exactly what's included in Dini Mamonos Bishlosha. The other way of reading it is that this general Dini Mamonos, and that's all inclusive, and then after that we're going to talk about exceptional cases that are in a sense fringe cases of Dini Mamonos.
So if you read it the first way, why you have a Bishlosha after Chavoah?
He's saying the following: Dini Mamonos Bishlosha, that's your overriding rule, right? Now I'm going to give you the subcategories, what's included under the principle of Dini Mamonos Bishlosha. You might ask why the Mishnah has to repeat the word Bishlosha.
That's right.
We're going to have that question over and over again. The word Bishlosha appears many, many times in this Mishnah. Right. The Gemara actually is going to conclude, if I remember correctly. I mean, the trouble with learning this Mishnah is you have to know the whole parak in order to really understand the Mishnah. So we're going to just fly through the Mishnah at a very fast pace. But if I remember correctly, the final maskon is going to be that Dini Mamonos Bishlosha is referring to X, Y, and Z, you know, those cases. And then we have the following other cases, which are additional cases. So the Dini Mamonos Bishlosha it covers most of the gamut. Like, for example, Rashi explains here at the very beginning that if I demand 1,000 from you because I lent you 1,000, and you deny that I lent you 1,000, so in such a case, that's called Dini Mamonos Bishlosha. And that doesn't match up to the next word in the Mishnah, which is gzelos, because there's no such thing as gezel on a shibud, right? So let's write down the word shibud, because that's going to come up over and over again. So anything that's in black, you don't have to pay attention to. Just pay attention to that which is in green, right? A shibud is a debt, right? A shibud is a debt, and a shibud, and any judgment about a shibud, let's say if I claim you're meshubah to me, you owe me a certain sum, and you deny the shibud, that comes under Dini Mamonos Bishlosha. Another case would be, let's say if I demand 1,000 and you agree that you owe me, let's say 500 out of the 1,000, right? That's called hodah, hodah spaldin, right? That's another case of Dini Mamonos Bishlosha, hodah. Okay, hodah means when a person admits that he owes money. So all these cases come under Dini Mamonos Bishlosha. But then we move on to another case, another area. It's also monetary jurisdiction. It's called gzelos. And within the category of gzelos, Rashi gives two cases. One case is going to be... Okay, how are we doing, Eitan? I didn't know you were coming today. Had I known, I would have had a drum roll.
I'll probably leave a little bit, but
you come for whatever time. If you have to leave, just the only thing is, if you might be interested in learning a little Parshas HaShavua, if that interests you, or a little bit of Musar, or a little bit of Shulchan Aruch with Mishnah Berurah. I don't know what you know, we have to sit and talk about that. Okay, so, but for the time being, I didn't know you were coming, so we started a new Masechta today.
Okay.
Which is called Masechta Sanhedrin. And what we've said so far is that if there's going to be some sort of judgment on Gzela, well, let's say Reuven accuses Shimon of stealing from him, then we're going to have to get a Beis Din together, and we have to get three judges. And less than three judges just won't do. So you might say, well, in a case of three judges, the majority will be made up of two out of the three judges. So why do we need a third judge? What if we have two judges with a unanimous opinion amongst those two judges? But there's going to be a concept that the Beis Din has to guarantee itself that there'll be one vote above the equal line. That's called a Beis Din She'eino Shakul, which means that you're going to have an odd number of judges on the court. If you have a Beis Din that's made up of an even number of judges, then you run the risk of having a stalemate. So let's say, for example, if you had 22 judges instead of 23.
Or 70.
Right, so if you had 22, you could end up with what? With a vote of 11-11, correct? Because it's an even number. And if you had two judges, it could be one against one, which is an even number. If you have 70 judges, it would be 35 against 35. So there's a halach that we need a Beis Din She'eino Shakul, meaning it definitely lends itself to a majority rule situation. So it's not enough to have two judges, even if those two judges would come to unanimous opinion, because the very makeup of the Beis Din requires that it's not an even number, but an odd number, so that we could tip the scale in favor of the majority, and therefore we need three judges. So again, let's go back to that case. So Reuven accuses Shimon of pickpocketing. That's called Gzela. Or, for example, the pasuk in Sefer Shmuel says, "Vayigzol es achanis miyad hamitzri." He steals the sword out of his hand. So, if I grab something out of your hand physically, you know, I'm physically imposing myself on you to the point to which I take something from you. That's called gzela. But Rashi has another case of gzela, which is fascinating. And that's where I deposit something in your possession and I ask you to guard it for me. Anybody know what that's called?
Bikaron.
Right, the object is called Bikaron, and the person that I'm depositing it in is
Shomer.
Correct. He's called the Shomer. Now, the Shomer is obligated in two different obligations. One is to return the object when the time comes, and the other is during the period of time that it's in his deposit, he has to guard the object. And again, there are different levels of a shomer. If he's a free shomer, he's not being paid. If he's a paid shomer, if he's renting something. In all these cases, there are different levels of what we call achrayut, what we call responsibility. He has to offer a greater and a higher level of shmira. So for example, if I want to protect money, the Gemara says, I have to actually dig a hole in the ground, or in our context, we call it a safe, you know, lock it up. So what is the level of negligence of Shia, or what is the level of Shmira in a positive sense that he has to offer? That's a very complicated business. But what does this have to do with Gzela? Rashi talks about depositing something in the hands of a caretaker, of a shomer. Where is the Gzela? So Rashi uses two different languages here, and it's interesting because it's not clear what Rashi has in mind. First, Rashi says, Kofer bipikadon. Do you see that on the top line of Rashi? Kofer bipikadon means I deny it. You know, you gave me a horse to watch in the stable, and I deny it. That horse is mine. I never got it from you. That's called kofer bipikadon. And in effect, you're stealing that horse, because by denying that it belongs to him, you're claiming it belongs to you. Although again, you haven't done a physical act of gzela. But by denying that it's his, you in effect have stolen the horse. You're a horse thief. You remember the famous story about the preacher who goes down south and he takes a position as a minister in a certain church, and in that community he heard they're guilty of stealing horses. So on the first lecture that he gave, you know, his first drasha, he said to them, thievery is so terrible, you know, and this. At the second lecture he said, you know, thievery undermines society. Every time he gave the lecture, the people stood up and they clapped. And then on the third lecture, he said, but horse thievery is the worst. And then they threw him out. So if you steal a horse, that's already serious stealing. In any event, Rashi now adds another word. And he says, Mishalech bo yad. Mishalech bo yad means that the person in whose care I deposited the object uses the object. See, he's not allowed to use the object. And that's called Shlichus Yad B'Pikud. There's an entire parasha in Sefer Shmos, in Parashas Mishpatim, called Shlichus Yad B'Pikud. So you gave me a horse. I'm meant to watch the horse, guard it, protect it, make sure it doesn't run away. I got to feed it. I got to make sure that everything is taken care of. And then I started riding the horse. So that's called Shlichus Yad B'Pikud. And Rashi seems to say that in this case he becomes a gazlan, because Rashi subsumes this under Gzela. Now, it means that if I use your object for my purposes and I don't have permission, license to do so, I am a gazlan. That's what Rashi's telling me. The question is where Rashi got this from. How does he know it? But let's go on. Chavolos. Chavolos is what we call assault. In other words, a person physically assaults someone and he causes a wound, he injures him, and he has to pay five categories of compensation. Eitan, are you familiar with that five category? You've heard of it? I don't know what you know, what you don't know. You know, you don't want to let on. You're growing a little sphere there, all right. So Thursday, I'll lend you my shaving. Hey, just kidding. So there's Nezek, Tzar, Ripui, Sheves, and Boshes. There are five categories of payment. And the category of payment that in a sense is most indicative of how unique Chavolos are in Halacha is what's called Boshes. So let's say if Reuven picks up a shovel and he smacks Shimon on the pardon the expression, on the backside, publicly, he humiliates him. So he has to pay a price for humiliating him. The Gemara has a whole sugya in Perek HaChov. How do you evaluate humiliation? But one thing is clear: humiliation is not compensation. I'm not compensating you for a loss. Again, you had a psychological loss; you were humiliated, but there's no monetary loss. So that makes Chavolos very unique. Or, for example, one of the five categories of payment is called Sheves, right? The fact that he couldn't go to work. Today we call it unemployment insurance. So that also is a very unique kind of a payment in the, in the context, the framework of paying compensation, because I'm not compensating you for a loss. The fact that you couldn't go to work and you couldn't get a profit, an employment check, that's only grumman, that's only an indirect cause. In any event, the bottom line is that Chavolos comes under a separate category with its own different types of payments, and it's not really a reflection of the normal Dini Mominus. Rabbi Chaim Brisker, my Rebbe used to always say, said that Chavolos is to replace the situation that you had before. It's a very unique kind of compensation. Then the Mishnah goes on after telling us that all the above require shlosha. The minimum requirement of judges is how many judges?
Three
judges. Less than three will not do. And now we go on to another category, which is called Shor HaMazik. Now, Shor HaMazik divides up into two subcategories. What are the two subcategories? Anybody know? Shor Tam and Shor Mur, correct? So a Shor Tam has not yet proven himself to be a belligerent animal. We think that it was just an occasional, he was in the hot sun, then he got angry and he started goring someone and destroying someone's property. So that happens three times. So the first three times that it happens, we hold the owner less than fully responsible. Obviously, he should have been more responsible about this ox. An ox is a very powerful animal. But he wasn't warned over and over and over again. Now, whenever you talk about over and over and over again, literally, it means how many times?
Three.
Three times. A hasra is three times. If a person violates... In other words, everything that we call a pattern in behavior requires three. I'll give you an example. In the case of a nida, if she has a re'iyas dam nida on, let's say, the 15th of the month, and again on the 15th of the following month, and then the third month, three times consecutively, that creates a chazaka, creates a pattern. In the case of a shor, if it gores three times, then that creates a pattern, and it indicates that the animal is a belligerent animal, and that jacks up the level of shmira, of protection that the Bailam are required to give. David?
Why is the category of this only talking about the short of gores? The short of also Duchenne or Legal, the damage the great besides groin.
Yeah, you're right. I shouldn't have limited this discussion to a shar of Karen, what we call Karen. Yeah, right. The reason why I mentioned Karen is because this Mishnah is going to distinguish between Chatzi Nezik and Nezik Sholem. That distinction only applies to one of the four of us Nezikin, and that's Karen. With regard to the others, like Shane, Regel, Mafir, and Hever, Fire, and so forth, it's always going to be an absolute total chiyuv. You pay the full Nezik, even on the first occasion. So, for example, if I would allow my animal, my sheep, to graze into your possession, then I have to know up front it's going to eat. And it's not a question of the animal has to prove itself to be a mazik. You know, it's clear from the get-go that this animal is a mazik. So if I always pay nezik sholin. In the case of a shar, which is called keren, here we distinguish between a shar tam and a shar mur. A shar tam is an animal that we have no reason to believe at this point is belligerent by its very nature, but a shar mu'ad means it's mu'ad. Mu'ad, the word mu'ad means that on certain occasions you know and you can predict that it's going to damage. So what's the difference between a shar tam and a shar mu'ad in terms of compensation? Let's go over this. A shar tam pays how much? Chatzi nezek, 50% of the nezek. A shar mu'ad pays 100% of the nezek, and that's because the owner of the shor was warned. He was warned with hasra on three occasions, over and over and over again, and he didn't provide the proper level of shmira, and therefore he's guilty. He has to pay nezek sholin. Now, in order to judge the shor, we're going to need a bezdin made up of what?
Three.
Now, not only in terms of judging the case and bezdin issuing a ruling of how much he has to pay, but even before that, we need a hasra. We need to warn him. So the first negicha, you're on the way towards mu'ad because you give him hasra number one. After the second negicha, hasra number two. After the third negicha, hasra number three. And he still was careless about watching his shor. So after the violation of the third hasra, he becomes chayev nezek sholem as a mu'ad. But this whole process has to take place in front of bezdin. So it means it's not enough if I come over to you and I say, Osher, you know, that big gory ox, he's a real belligerent ox. That's not enough. That's not a hasra. It has to take place in front of bezdin.
Two Adam would be enough.
Two Adam would not be enough. The Adam would have to testify on the negicha. Bezdin, after accepting the Adam, and being mechayev mechatzi nezek, now they give him the hasra. And this happens three times over. Then he becomes a shor mu'ad. So it's very interesting. Becoming a shor mu'ad is not just the result of the negicha. The negicha itself doesn't generate the change in status. I need the negicha together with the hasra, and the hasra has to be in front of bezdin. So in effect, this transition in the state of the animal, halachically, is effectuated by bezdin, not just by the shor itself. Obviously, bezdin is not going to do so without the shor's participation. Then we get to the case of a ganav. You know, a ganav is a burglar who steals, not by, you know, accosting you directly and saying, give me your money or your life, that's a goslin, but a ganav does it stealthily. A burglar, you know, he breaks into your house during the nighttime, and the Torah is very, very strict about a ganav, because a ganav doesn't care about God, he cares about man. And he says that I'm afraid of man, and therefore I'm going to do it on the cloak of darkness. So the Torah says a ganav has to pay kefel. That means an extra 100% of the value of what he stole. So for example, let's say a ganav, you know, steals your chicken, you have to give him two chickens, or at least the value of the second chicken. And that's called a knas. Knas kuf nun samach. Let's write that down, because that's, again, I always write down on the board the key words that I want you to make a note of. Bless you. A knas. And a knas is a monetary penalty. How do I judge whether it's a knas or not? If it's beyond compensation. Okay, it doesn't replace that which you lost. So the first 100%, which is called the Karen, right? Ha-Karen, Right, that's the principle, not PLE but PAL, right, if I remember correctly. And that's the value of the object that was stolen. So that's called tashlume mamon. That's a payment, a compensation mamon. Then there's kefel, which means the extra 100%, right? And that's called a knas. So for example, there are laws about the makeup of Sanhedrin that distinguish between mamon and knas. Mamon being the first 100% and knas the second. And this touches on a whole nother topic, which we're not ready for now. I'll just give you a preview of coming attractions. And that has to do with what's called smicha. Now, smicha literally means an unbroken chain from Moshe Rabbeinu of ordination. And for knas, we need that unbroken chain. So you can't just sit on a bezdin. Like, I respect everyone here in the room, but if I gather three people together, and I include myself in this, right, we're not able to deal with knossos. Because for knossos, we need smicha. But we don't have smicha today. You know, we have what's called a heter hora. You know, you get ordination means that the rabbis recognize your level of scholarship so that you could be mora hora. You could tell a person that if he cooked in a pot and he cooks parv in a pot and he earlier cooked fleishiks, can he eat that with milk? So that's a heter hora. But for knas, you need a smuchin. You know, that's a higher level of a bezdin, which we don't really have today. So the question is going to be, and this is a sugya later on, do we have the ability today, through bezdin, of forcing a person to pay double if he's a thief, and he's chayev tashlume kefel? Now, not only is there a knas of kefel, there's also a knas of arba'a v'chamisha. And this depends on what you stole. If you stole a light animal, a lightweight animal, right, that's called a seh, or a sheep, then you only pay up to 400%, which is a lot of money, but it's only that far. If, on the other hand, you stole a shor, then you would have to pay as much as 500%. So the shor is worth 100, you're going to be ending up paying, you thief, 500. And all this is judged by a court made up of three judges. Okay. Now we go on to onus u'mafata. Here, we're talking about another kind of knas. We're talking about a case of a nara besula, right? So she's a girl above the age of 12, below the age of 12 and a half. So it's just that six-month period of time of narus. There's one opinion that we can extend it from the time that she's 3 years old up to the time that she is 12 and a half. Meaning even a katana is included in this parasha. And that's the subject of my discussion at 11:45 when we learn Masechet Ksuvos, or my discussion at 7:30 in Birtz Hashem in the Shtiblach. For anyone who's around, for those early minyanim in the Shtiblach, you know. So how much do you pay in a case of a Naira Besula? She's a girl, let's say between 12 and 12 and a half, has never had a relationship with a man. And now somebody either seduces her, which is called mafata, or rapes her, nebuch, it's called ma'anes. And it's both of these cases, the Torah says, the two different parashas in the Torah says that you have to pay 50 kesef, chamishim kesef, is a knas. Once again, it's a knas because in addition to the 50 kesef that he has to pay, chamishim kesef, which is explicitly written in the Torah, it says kimora v'sulos. In addition to that, he has to pay nezek. Okay, that's called pgam or nezek. So all this comes under monetary law, and therefore, it is judged by three judges. But then we get to a much more profound case. Also of a man who's having a relationship with a besula, but in this case, it's his own wife. Now, how could you have a case where a man consummates a marriage with his own wife, and yet he has to pay damages? And we'll see, it goes way beyond paying damages. That's called in the language of the Mishnah, Motzi Shemra. So let's just go over the basics. Again, yeah, I apologize if this is just so basic that you're laughing at me, but I like to go through the basics to make sure that we're all on board. There's one marriage, stage one, which is called Erusin, otherwise known as Kiddushin. Those terms of are synonymous. And then we wait a period of time. Classically, back in the Gemara's time, they waited a 12-month period of time until Nisuin, until they consummated the marriage under the chuppah. For that 12-month period of time, she's living in her father's house. And then he takes her into his own house at the end of this period, and that's called Nisuin. Now, as far as her status as an Eishes Ish, at what point does she become an Eishes Ish? Is it Erusin, or do we have to wait till Nisuin? Erusin. Already with Erusin, he says, Areat Mekudeshes Li, he gives her something of value, and now she is an Eishes Ish. Anyone who has relations with her, both he and she, will be Chayv Skila, they'll get punished with a cardinal sin as Bias Eishes Ish. Now what happens is, we don't know what happened during the 12-month period. We have every reason to assume innocent until proven guilty. And now, when the husband comes to consummate the marriage, he claims, this is 12 months after the Erusin, that lo and behold, he found it to be a Ba'ula. Right? A Ba'ula. Which means that he found that she already had a relationship. Now again, exactly how he knows this is the subject of the first Perek of Ksubis. Now, if he makes this claim, he may be lying through his teeth. But basically, he's saying two things. So one, he's saying that I didn't get my money's worth over here. You know, I didn't get what I paid for. I wanted a basula and I found it to be a ba'ula. But more than that, what he's saying is that if she really had this relationship, as he accuses her of having done, then she gets capital punishment. Now, of course, we're going to need aid then. We're going to need witnesses. So let's give the following scenario. Let's say a man, when he consummates his marriage, he comes running into Bezdin the very next morning, on a Monday or a Thursday when Bezdin sat, and he puts forth a claim that he found her to be a ba'ula, and she was not loyal to him during this period of time. Then he subpoenas two witnesses into court, and they testify on his behalf that she had this relationship with another man during the 12 months. Then what happens is, we prove that these witnesses perjured themselves. Do you know how we do that? Does anybody know how we can prove that they perjured themselves? Excellent. That's called Eidim Zomerman, which means another pair of Eidim come in and say, well, they couldn't have possibly seen that crime on the day and the place that they claim they did, because on that day and that time and place, they were elsewhere. Thus, they weren't in Chicago, they were in New York, and it's too far for them to have made that trip within that period of time. So now that we've disproven the Eidim, we now know that this man set up the entire, you know, it was a setup. The whole thing was a fabrication. And that's called Motzi Shemra. Motzi Shemra literally means he slanders her, and he says, I accuse her of having this relationship. He goes ahead and he brings two witnesses. And in such a case, the Mishnah paskins that Bishlosha, you know, we could judge this case with three judges. And the reason for that is because the punishment for his being Motzi Shemra is that he has to pay a fine. And that fine is Meir Kesef. Divrei Rabbi Meir. This is the opinion of Rabbi Meir. So again, let's just summarize. According to Rabbi Meir, the case of Motzi Shemra, where he fabricated this slander against his wife, is a dini mominis case. It's a monetary case because it deals with the tashlum, the payment of Meir Kesef, and therefore requires three judges.
I'm just wondering, with the Eidim Zomerman in this case, are they liable to the death penalty? Because the woman would have been put to death. So the Eidim Zomerman themselves.
So let's just read one more line in the Mishnah.
If they're not, why would the man not be?
Let's just read one more line in the Mishnah, David. V'chachamim omrim, motzi shema b'esrim v'shlosha. It's not enough to judge this case with three judges. Mipnei sheyeshbo dinei nefashos. Right? Because what's at stake here? He brings in two witnesses to support his claim that she in fact had this illegitimate relationship, this Mises Nus, during the 12-month period of Erusin, and these Eidim are basically testifying that she deserves the death penalty. If that be the case, as we're going to assume in the second part of this long Mishnah, then we have a Dini Nefashos case. We're talking about a capital case. And a capital case requires 23 judges, no less. So it seems that according to Rabbi Meir, we don't judge this as a capital case because it's the father of this girl who is suing for damages this Motzi Shemra who's fabricating this story. Now it's true that as a result of this story, we're going to have another judgment. And the second judgment is going to be, she'll be on trial, because if these witnesses are telling the truth, then she has to be put to death. So it's a Dinei Nefashos case. But Rabbi Meir is willing to separate the two, and he's willing to focus exclusively right now on the Mea Kesef, which is the sum of the lawsuit, of the suit that's being brought by the father of this Nara, of this girl, against the Baal, to the effect that your Edom are false, the whole story is a slander, it's a fabrication, you got to pay me Mea Kesef. Therefore says Rabbi Meir, Bishlosha. Chacham on the other hand said, let's look at the case in its broader perspective. What are the implications here? And that is that when these two witnesses come to testify on behalf of the Baal to substantiate his claim that he found her to be a Ba'ula, they are testifying on a capital crime. So the Chacham are not willing to say, well, let's split it into two. Let's deal first and foremost as an independent case with the Tviya of the father and say, well, he's being Tovea Mamon, 100 Mea Kesef. No. Let's look at the broader context and the repercussions of this case. The ruling is not going to be on whether he has to pay 100. There's going to be a much more profound ruling on whether or not she indeed had this Mises Nus and whether or not we could prove through these witnesses adduced by the Baal that she indeed performed an act which is capital in punishment. So Ritz Hashem, Belineder will get to the sugya itself, and the Gemara is going to have a long battle here between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, but just to, you know, we say L'saber to Ozen, just to get the get our feet wet, this is what is going on. Okay. Now we get to corporeal punishment. So we said before that if it's a cardinal sin for which you have one of Dalad Mises Bezdin, for that we need a court that comprises 23 judges. And the end of this mission is going to be dedicated to an analysis. How do we know that it's 23? How did the Mishnah come up with the number 23? But now we're saying that, you know what, even before we get to capital cases, there is such a thing as onesh haguf. There is a corporeal physical punishment, which is called malchus, which means that if you violate any of the averis, the losa says in the Torah, so it says in Kitetz, I'll just read the pasuk to you, which you don't have in the Mishnah, I have it here in a note. The pasuk says, "V'haya im ben hakos arasha, v'pila shofet v'ikol lefanav," etc. And then it says, "Arboim yakenu," he has to get 40 lashes. Lo yosif. So the Chazal at the end of Masechta Makos is darshan that when it says "v'mispar arboim," it means that if you round off the number, it's 40, but it really means 39 malchus. Now, 39 malchus is a corporeal punishment on the physical body of a person. So here we have a gigantic machlokas between the Tanakam and Rabbi Shmuel. How do we judge, how do we classify a chiyuv malchus? So two witnesses come in, they testify that Reuven ate chazir and that we gave mahasra, and now we have to give him 39 malchus. So the Tanakam says shlosha, meaning Tanakam says that anything other than Misa, other than death, the death penalty, comes under Dini Mominus. And again, it's not Dini Mominus. Obviously, we're dealing with criminal and punitive law. But it's not Dini Nefashos. Anything less than Dini Nefashos is called Dini Mominus. Mishum Rabbi Shmuel Amru, Bi Esrim Vishlosha. The Gemara is going to try to explain this later on in Daf Yud, an entire sugya, how to explain Rabbi Shmuel. Why does he require 23 judges for Malchus? Now here I want to share with you a footnote in the Masifta, which is coming from the Taz. You know, the Taz lived 4.5 centuries ago. And he's bothered by the following question. Hatam shal Mishnah lo kol as kol hadinim atzrichim shlosha bevasachas. Why didn't the Mishnah just give me an exhaustive list of all the cases that have to be judged by three dayanim? Why was the Mishnah so careful about dividing it up into smaller groups? So he says the following. Mishum sheyesh bi echad ma she'ein b'sheini. Each group has something unique that doesn't apply to the previous group, and therefore it sets itself up as a separate chidush. You know, a Mishnah wants to be mechadish. For example, we spoke about gzelos and chavolos. You know, this is already a criminal act. It's not just a matter of denying someone money in payment, but you actually steal something from him. Or, for example, we spoke about shara muad and shara ha'atam. That makes it a separate category. Onis ha'mafata with a knas of chamishim kesef. Oh, now he offers a separate answer to this question. Mishum sheyesh lem limud nifrat. In every single category, we're going to need its own yalfusa, a derivation to prove that we require no more than the basic bezdin made up of three. Oh, here's his third possibility. Sheyesh bam dover chidush. Then in each case, we have a hava mina that maybe we should up the ante on how many judges we should have. So the Mishnah says, v'shlosha. So separate chidush. He says the following, Dini Mominus, Chalukim, Igzelos, Vechavolos. There's a fundamental difference between general Dini Mominos and the cases of Gzelos, Vechavolos. Mishum, Shedai, Beshlosha, Dayonim, Hedyotos. Okay, this is a sugya later on, which we're going to get to very, very soon. I don't know if we'll get to it tomorrow, or maybe the day after tomorrow. That in general Dini Mominos, all we need are Hedyotos. So mostly that means that the three of us to get together and form a bezdin. Not so in the cases of gzelos and chavolos. There we need mumchim. Now again, whether mumchim is identical to the word that I wrote on the board, smuchim or not, is going to be another issue. So let's assume, just to make life easy for ourselves and brush it under the rug, that mumchim equals smuchim. So you need smicha in order to comprise dayanim of a bezdin for gzelos and chavolos. And it's not enough that you have hedyotos. And then we have nezek v'chatzi nezek. Nezek and chatzi nezek, as we said before, might require a hasra in the case of nezek sholem. Or, for example, there might be a certain equation between nezek and gzela. Onus u'mafata is a chiddush that even though it's a set amount of price, there's no, it doesn't, what word I want to use, it doesn't shift. Oh, it's a fixed price. Okay, I think that's a good word. It's a fixed, what's the opposite of a fixed price? A shifting price. No, there's got to be a
variable.
Variable. Okay. Yeah, I'm looking for a word. It's like, anyway, so what's unique about onus and mafata that any time a bezdin has to judge this, it's a schum kavua, it's a fixed price. And in Makos, the Mishnah has to have a separate paragraph because of the great machlokas with regard to Malkus, whether or not we require 23 judges. Now the Mishnah is going to go on to another unique case, and that has to do with the calendar year, which is called Iber Shana or Iber Chodesh, which means that because of the discrepancy between the lunar calendar and the solar calendar, which if I'm not mistaken is an 11-day discrepancy on every year, so over the course of years, you know, you accumulate a distance of over 30 days. And therefore at some point we have to make up to make sure that Pesach is B'Chodesh Aviv, and therefore we need Iber Hashana. And it's going to be a whole complicated system of judgment for Iber Hashana. We're going to start with three judges, we're going to add another two judges, then add four judges, so we get seven judges. And then we have Iber HaChodesh, right? We have to determine whether the moon appeared after 29 days or only after 30 days. Is it a Chodesh Chaser, a Chodesh Mole? But to make a short story long, every single paragraph here is a separate chidush with its own unique dinim. Now, if we're talking about Iber HaChodesh, adding an extra month to make up for Iber HaShana, then we're talking about Chodesh HaAviv. to guarantee where Pesach is. But if we're talking about Ibur HaChodesh, not Ibur HaShana, then I would ask you the following question. What is the first mitzvah in the Torah? Excellent. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodoshim. So that means that the Torah commands us with a mandate. It's included in the 613. The mitzvah of listening and accepting the testimony of two witnesses, two Edom Ksherim, in front of Beis Din, and they testified that they saw what's called the Levana Bechidusha, the brand new moon. And then based on the testimony of these two witnesses, Beis Din will then declare Mekudosh, Mekudosh, Mekudosh. They will declare that the new month has been sanctified. That's called HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodoshim. Once they determine that this is the new month, then there's no backs. There's no changing that. Even if they made a mistake, we still have established through a Beis Din. Now, where is this Beis Din? You know, we divide up courts or systems of courts into two. There's in Eretz Yisrael and there's outside Eretz Yisrael. So it would seem, and again, this is going to be a sugya, a very profound sugya later on, that the process of Kiddush HaChodesh and this mitzvah is given within the bounds of Eretz Yisrael. That means a Beis Din in Chutz Laaretz would not have the jurisdiction, the authority to determine when is the new month. And as a result of Golus, they had to find a different system of setting up the new month, and that's called Kiddush al pi cheshbon, as opposed to Kiddush al pi re'iyah. Al pi re'iyah means re'iyas eidim. We needed two witnesses to testify, and then after that possibility was completely obliterated, then what we have is Kiddush al pi cheshbon, and that was the calendar that was organized by Hillel Hasheni in the 5th century. So the Mishnah establishes that both Ibur HaChodesh, adding an extra day to the month, and Ibur HaShana, both are Bishlosha. All we need is a Beis Din of three. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Now the Chiddush of Rabbi Meir is that even in the case of Ibur HaShana, where we added a full month to the year, a second Adar, we don't need any more than three judges. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, yeah, we start with three judges, but there's going to be a whole investigation, a back and forth. So maschilin b'shlosha, shlosha maschilin, meaning they have to start the judgment. They realize that, you know, 3 years have passed and there's a full month's discrepancy between the lunar and solar calendars. But they're not ready to issue a final ruling. First, they have to have more deliberation. B'chamisha nosim v'nosnim. We're going to add two extra judges comprising five, and that's going to be the deliberation on the more advanced level. And finally, when they're ready to issue the final ruling that we want to add another month to the year, Gomrim, we complete that, Bishiva with seven judges, we're going to add another two, so we now have seven judges. Even Rabbi Shimon, the Mishnah says, agrees that b'di'evet im gamru b'shlosha, if there were only three judges, me'uberes, it is a valid Ibur HaShana, and we do add an extra month. But l'chadchila, if all things are equal, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel requires three, five, and seven. Again, the Gemara is going to have a long sugya to explain the shita of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Next, smichas zakenim. Now, when you hear that phrase smichas zakenim, what do you think it's referring to?
An old rabbi,
right? To give ordination to a rabbi so that he could serve on a Beis Din, and not only on a Beis Din, it becomes a Beis Din shel smuchim, which, as we said before, has an uninterrupted smicha that's been transmitted all the way from Moshe Rabbeinu in Har Sinai. And that gives them a special status. They can judge dinei chavolos and knossos and gzelos. But that's not the way Rashi learns this mission. And for that matter, that's not the way any of the Rishonim, with the exception of one, learn this Mishnah. They all assume that this Mishnah is talking about a different smicha entirely. Not when we lean our hands on a rabbi to make him into an ordained rabbi, but we're leaning our hands on a cow. And that means we're designating this cow for a specific carbon. Which carbon are we dealing with? Parhelim Dovah Shel Tzibur. This means that a Beis Din issued a psak, and that psak was relevant to what's called a Chiyuv Kares, a very severe violation, and it was a mistaken psak. And Rov HaTzibur, most of the community of Israel, relied on that ruling and they violated an Issur Kares. In such a case, the Torah commands us to bring a Par Helem Dover Shel Tzibur. And for a Par Helem Dover Shel Tzibur, we're going to need, at least according to Rabbi Yehuda, a higher level of a Beis Din. So the Beis Din is going to now have to judge as to whether or not all the conditions necessary to obligate us in a parallel dovshal were fulfilled, being that the toast, there was a mistake in the Oros Beis Din on something that's an Issur Kares, and the Tzibur actually relied upon them. Once Beis Din has made that determination, we bring a cow, and that cow is called a cow chatos, a par chatos. Chatos is always for the purpose of kapora, and that keeps the world going. And this par helim dovashal tzibur requires before the shechita smicha, the ziknei ha'eda, the elders of the community. I don't know how many, but there's going to be a representation of the elders of the community. They have to place their hands on the head of this cow in the Beis HaMikdash, and then we're going to be makriv that korban chatos called the par helim dovar shel tzibur. And if you want to learn all the unique halachas of a par helim dovar shel tzibur, you have to learn Masechta Zvachim. I'm not talking about the kodshim part, you know, about where the shechita is, and if the zrika is bifnim, if it's not, the shirayim, all that you have to learn zvachim. The Gemara here in Masechta Rosh Hashanah Daf Yud Gimel is going to discuss another kind of smicha, and the Rambam is in his Pirush HaMishnayis on our Mishnah, he's going to learn our Mishnah and interpret it based on the second opinion in the Gemara on Daf Yud Gimel, that we're talking about minui dayonim, appointing judges. And we want to make the judges into what's called smuchim, again, for that higher level of Beis Din. And the Rambam says that's what our Mishnah has in mind when it says smicha zakenim. It's referring to the smicha of a zaken, making him into a dayon samuch. So when he receives the smicha, this is implemented in the presence and by three dayonim. That's called minui dayonim. And we'll have a lot to talk about in Mitzvah Shem regarding the mitzvah of minui dayonim, appointing judges. That's one of the most profound subjects of the first parak of Sanhedrin. I want to again read to you a few lines here in Masifta. He says the following. There's a machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon regarding smichas zakenim, and the Rambam assumes that that's what our Mishnah is recording, whether or not smichas zakenim is bishlosha, or that's Rabbi Shimon or Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, bichamisha, you need five. He says the following. What happens in a case, this is in Parshas Ki Teitze in Dvarim Chaf Aleph, when they find a slain body in between two cities? What's that called, Rabbi Osai? Eglarufa. Excellent. Eglarufa. We don't know who is responsible for this murder, and we assume that the murderer came out of one of two cities. So now we need the highest court in the land, which is called the Sanhedrin Agdola, and that's made up of 71 elders, and they are in charge of what's called Medida. Medida means that in the first stage of Egla Rufa, we need to measure from the exact location where the body, the slain body was found, and the two cities that are closest, sometimes it could be more than two cities, until we finally determine which is the closest city. But yet, even though the Torah requires that this process be initiated by the Sanhedrin, which is made up of 71 elders, Chazal understood in Torah Shebaal Peh that the Sanhedrin HaGedolah could send representatives, and they are the representatives of the Sanhedrin. And again, we have machlokas. How many representatives do we need? Rabbi Shimon says three is sufficient. Rabbi Yehuda requires five. And they will represent Sanhedrin for a two-stage process. Stage number one is Medida, Medida means to measure the distance between what? The slain body. What's that called in Hebrew, the slain body? Anybody know? Chet, Lamed, Lamed, a Chalal. Again, if I had time, I'd write it on the back blackboard, the whiteboard. And this Chalal is the dead body. And then stage number two, after they determine which city is the closest city, they have a ritual process called Arifa. Arifa means they break the neck of the cow in a place called the Nachal Eis, on a very tough piece of ground. And there's going to be a machlokes as to how many zakenim we need to, number one, initiate the process of medida and implement this measurement. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it's going to be 5. According to Rabbi Shimon, all we need is 3. And the Gemara is going to go through the various shittas.
Is this in Sota?
Sota, yeah. Half of Masechta Sota is dedicated to Egel Aruf.
And I thought that even there's one spot that says that the entire Sanhedrin goes out the first time.
Right.
So it's like a whole focus on.
Our Mishnah seems to be reflective of the shita that all they need is that the Sanhedrin go out and then they have representatives to implement the Medida, and they represent the entire Sanhedrin. Chalitza. Now, chalitza means that you want to know whether or not this woman can get married. Her husband died, leaving her childless, and he left a brother, a live brother. So the late brother is the Baal HaZika, meaning he generates a Zika. This I'll write on the board just to make sure. Zika. And Zika means that the original marriage relationship, which is called Ishus, between a husband and a wife, now in a sense reflects itself. It's almost bequeathed, if I could use that term, to the Yavam, right? The Yavam, right? The live brother. And he has two choices, in theory, and that is either to marry this woman, Lahakim Shem, or Zerali Achiv Hames, or he can give Chalitza. And if he gives Chalitza, then as a result of Chalitza, she can marry anyone. Because as long as there's a Zikas Yibum without Chalitza, then there's what's called an Isur Lotia Ha'isha Azos Ha'eshis Hames Ha'chutza Lishzar, which means that the wife of the deceased cannot marry an Ish Zar. And that's called the Iser of Yevama Lashuk, otherwise known as Zika. And to remove that Isha's relationship and allow her to marry anyone,
except a
coin, we need Chalitza. How many people in this room have ever actually witnessed Chalitza? I'm just curious. Oh, it's kedai to see. If they ever call you in, it is the most emotional ceremony you'll ever want to be at. Everybody's crying. And again, everyone's laughing and happy. You know, it's a relief that finally they got the get. You know, in this country, for example, you could wait. There's such a backlog. You know, you could wait a year or two until you get the get. Hopefully, we're improving that now that they appointed a whole new cadre of Dayan. But chalitza is a very emotional thing. I was present at a chalitza. Also, chalitza is fascinating because the bezin has a nal. They actually have 3 different sizes. And they choose based on the foot, you know, whether it fits the foot. It has to be a nal of chalitza. So how many judges have to preside over a chalitza? And the answer is 3 judges. Now there's a big chiddush here in this Mishnah, because a chalitza is to a yevama what a get is to an eishes ish. And yet in the case of a get, we don't need the presence of anyone except for the eidim. But here in the case of Chalitza, the Gemara derives in Masechta Yevamos, of course, from the Pasuk in Ki Teitzei that we need that this process of Chalitza take place in the presence of Dayanim, because the Torah says, quote, V'im lo yachpotza ish lo kachas es yevimto, V'olso yevimto hashara el azkenim, meaning that this process of Chalitza must take place in the presence of a Bezdin. So they have to actually see the chalitza. First they see the nal, they check out the nal, make sure it has the status of a nal, it's not ripped or anything like that. And then they watch as she, the Yavama, removes the nal from his foot. And Viorekes Milafonov, she spits in front of him and then has the Kriyas HaParsha. She has to recite the Parsha of Kocha, Ye Osel Isha Shalo Yivnes Beis Echov, Ochiv. And it's very interesting because what happens if she doesn't know how to read this Parsha, or for example, if she's mute? Whole sugyas in the Gemara about that. Very similar to Mikra Bikurim, you know, where there's a mitzvah bringing the Bikurim and to recite a parasha.
So based in here, really, is being like a Natsahari. They're saying we test it, but not really judging it. They're saying we witness this is happening.
So, David, let me say, if you don't mind, I'm going to say what you said, but in my own language.
Please.
Excellent.
I'm
going to leave out the word witnessing, although you're right. I mean, Beis Din is going to witness this. But in law, and this is true even in secular law, we distinguish between something that's called constructive and something called declarative. Constructive means where we have to reconstruct the case and we have to adduce evidence and decide exactly what happened. And that's your classical case of judgment based on testimony and evidence. Then there's something called declarative. Declarative means where you need a court in order to change some legal status. Like, for example, I don't know if this is a good example, but in many countries in the West, if you want to become a citizen, then you have to declare in front of a court your loyalty to the country that you're becoming a citizen in. There, the court is not playing a role of determining or adducing evidence or testifying, but rather they're making a new transition, a new state, a new legal state. They're changing your status in that country, and now you become a citizen. It's interesting that lahavdil between, there's a fundamental difference in Jewish law as far as divorce and secular law. In secular law, to a large extent, the concept of going in front of a justice of the peace, you know, to declare that you're divorced, and I think both he and she have to show up together, if I remember correctly. That's a little bit different. That's not a testimony. Again, there may be a, what do they call it, the clerk of the court, you know, who types out, you know, the document. But really, the court is effectuating a divorce. Here, in the case of halacha, the court doesn't effectuate the divorce. They have to clarify that there was a divorce, but that divorce could have taken place without any presence of Beis Din. Not so in the case of chalitza. In chalitza, Beis Din actually creates the chalitza. The chalitza has to be in front of the Beis Din. And that's what the Torah means when it says, V'olso yevimto hashara el azkenim. This entire process has to be effectuated in the presence of and by Beis Din. Beis Din actually creates the Chal Hashem. Okay. Now we get to Miyun. Does anybody remember what Miyun is?
She refuses. The
Ketana. Ketana, Yisoma. Yisoma, Shenisei, Sal Yidei.
Imo,
the Acheho. Oh, right. Excellent. So it means that this is not Kiddushei Torah. Kiddushei Torah for Ketana only apply when the father marries off his daughter. Now the father did not marry off his daughter as a Ketana from 0 to 12. He died. So he's out of the picture. However, the Chachamim made a Takana to establish what we call Kiddushei Derabanan, a marriage which is valid on a rabbinic level. And that means that if her mother, instead of her father, marries her off, or perhaps if her brother marries her off, then she's considered married, we'll soon see on a temporary basis at least, as Kiddushei Derabbana. Now, with regard to Kiddushei Torah, to break up Ishus, you need a get, or Misa Sabah. In the case of Kiddushei Derabbanan, you need what's called Miyun. But the cool thing about Miyun is that when she makes a declaration, I don't want to be married to this man, then Miyun is Oker Lemafreya. That retroactively, it's as if they were never married. And she declares, and we'll soon see in front of a Beis Din of three, Efshi, which means Ein Ritzoni, Biploni Bali. And immediately when she makes that declaration in front of a Beis Din, she can marry anyone else.
They call that a weasel clause.
Is that what it's called? No, you have to write that down for me.
You can back out and
yeah, send it to me in an email, because I'm not familiar with that term at all. Now again, all this applies only before she hits the magic birthday of 12. Once she hits her 12th birthday and she's still living with him, those kiddushin that Ishus Derabbanan now automatically upgrades or develops and matures and becomes kiddushei Torah, and she'll need a get. So this process of chalitza or miyun, and I'm tempted to think that when the Rabbanan established miyun, they required the same amount of judges as chalitza, and for the same reason. And just like we said in chalitza, it's the Beis Din that creates the chalitza, so too in miyun, it's Beis Din that creates the miyun. So for example, if she would be ma'enis in front of two witnesses, and then those two witnesses would testify in front of Beis Din, that would not be an effectual miyun, because she has to achieve and implement the miyun in the presence of three dayan. Now, the next major section in this Mishnah, which we're not going to have time for today, is about what's called ha'aracha. Okay, it's an important word, ha'aracha. And that means that whenever the Torah requires a certain value, and I'll give you an example, then how do we make that evaluation? How do we determine that this object is worth X? That has to take place in front of a Beis Din. So the classic case would be Maser Sheni. So for example, I have 1,000 bushels that I separated as Maser from my produce. Now I have to take that Maser Sheni, which is again on the first, second, fourth, and fifth years, I have to take that to Yerushalayim, but I can't take 1,000 bushels to Yerushalayim. It's just logistically impossible. So the Torah says, "Menasata kesev, v'tzarta kesev biyadech," you're allowed to redeem them. And you transfer the Kedusha from the Beros over to the Mama. But that Mama, those coins have to have the equivalent value of the Maaser Sheni. So if my Maaser Sheni of 1,000 bushels is worth $1,000 and I transfer it over to 500, that's not a valid pidyon. But who shots this up? Who's going to make this evaluation, this haracha, to determine what is the exact value of these payrolls? And that's what the Mishnah is going to embark upon now, that we need a Beis Din, and we're not exactly sure how many members of the Beis Din there are. It seems from the Mishnah that you need three. But then the Gemara is going to talk about a case of Hegdesh, where let's say I take my piece of real estate and I magdish it to Vedic Abayis. It means I say I raise a Hegdesh. And in that case, it's not going to be enough that we have three judges. We're going to need 10 judges. Now, we've never come across the number 10. And we still haven't determined how we know 3 and how we know 23 and 71. But what's pretty unique about this harocha is that at least in Hegdish on Karkos, we're going to require a Beis Din of 10. The next part of the Mishnah is going to deal with Dine Nefashos. And how do we derive that Dine Nefashos require 23? So Mirtz Hashem, by tomorrow, I'm hoping we'll have finished the first Mishnah in Masechtas Sanhedrin, which sounds like Dvarim Shel Mavakach. It's no big deal, you know, you don't deserve to wave a flag for that, but it is probably the longest Mishnah in Shas. Wow. So it's not bad if we accomplish that by tomorrow. Alright then, I wish everyone a great day.
So we're going to Sanhedrin as well with your